And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. Let's get into our commentary for today. Our commentary is entitled Forests and Waters and was written by Sam Hayes. The close connection between water and forests has long been a critical feature of forest management. But over the years, that connection has played a lesser role in forest affairs and has been far less on the minds of forest specialists. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, it was a dominant feature in forest policy. In the 1890s, protection of water supplies was the major drive to establish national forests in the West. Protection of the water supplies of the Erie Canal and the Hudson River was a major feature of the move to establish the Adirondack Park in New York, and passage of the Weeks Act in 1911, which authorized purchase of lands in the eastern national forests. It was also the primary objective in establishing the state forests of Pennsylvania and was the major reason why the administrative agency that was responsible for managing the state forests was called the Department of Forests and Waters. By the time of the environmental era, however, much of this has changed. By that time, the forest establishment had developed the rationale that forests and watersheds were detrimental to water resources, since their main result was to create evaporation, and that to cut down trees increased the water runoff and hence water supply to water users. At the same time, the federal and state water quality programs had led to a new and separate agencies. Quite different professionals were now responsible for water quality programs that were quite separate from forest agencies, and the forest agencies seemed to be quite willing to disavow much responsibility for either the water supply or water quality on the grounds that they were the responsibility of others. A few things have changed in recent years to bring the positive role of forests for water back into the picture. One is the realization that water pollution is not just a product of point source discharges into lakes and rivers, but that non-point sources are also responsible: runoff from farms and forests, from building construction sites, and from urban streets. As part of this picture, the forest community has realized that it might well bear some responsibility for the non-point source problem, and so has taken upon itself the challenge of establishing best management practices for the conduct of practices in the woods, such as tree harvesting. The issue has been whether or not these should be mandatory, established through some regulatory action, or voluntary. While in some cases in the West they have been mandatory, most have been voluntary, stating in a list of such best practices that this or that should be done rather than must be done, and providing no supervision beyond voluntary agreement on compliance. Most of these pertain to soil disturbing practices such as road construction, log hauling and yarding, or other timber harvest practices, and require replanting of areas where the soil was disturbed. In response to the question has arisen as if they work, do they do the job they are supposed to do? Only limited monitoring has been done to determine the answer to that question. In Pennsylvania, a private group dominated by the wood production establishment, working through a loose organization known as the Forest Issues Working Group, drew up a best management plan statement that provides only verbal objectives and gives little guarantee that what is stated as desired goals actually works out. Attempts even to tighten the statement slightly have not succeeded, as the best management practices have been played out, for example, within the context of the federal non-point source program. It has been argued that the cumulative effects of several different non-point sources should be brought into play to determine what works and what does not work. The wood production community has resisted such an approach. All of this has emphasized sedimentation from soil-disturbing practices, and often the focus is placed on buffer zones, with the statement that a satisfactory buffer zone has been adopted. The role of the zones is quite limited. The width of the zone in the east is usually 50 feet, and most of this is a selection cutting rather than a no-harvest zone. In Washington State, where the issue has been intense for a number of years with respect to state forest lands, recent negotiations have led to an increase in the no-harvest zone from 25 to 75 feet, but this is contested by Environmental Forestry advocates who draw upon scientific opinion that 250-foot buffers are essential to provide for adequate salmon spawning. An adequate buffer zone remains a deep bone of contention with the timber companies seeking to obtain the positive public image of maintaining one, and yet at the same time seeking to reduce its effect on harvest practices as much as possible. In the administration of forest practice acts in the West, this is a major bone of contention. But in the East, there is little regulation at all, and hence the question of buffer zones and the control of non-point source pollution remains of little consequence, either in terms of voluntary statements of intention or general statutory statements that are not seriously enforced. One possible approach to this problem is for forest managers to adopt a policy of citizen monitoring in which, much as is the case with water quality monitoring, citizens could conduct monitoring of best management practices in a timely fashion at the time that soil-disturbing practices are carried on. Monitoring carried out by Citizens Forest Watch in Virginia has played an important role in raising the entire issue of forests and waters to a more visible public level there. There's much to be said for the improvement in how the effect of forests on water quality is dealt with in forest management. Recently, this entire issue was debated extensively in Maine, and the governor of Maine asked the Maine Water Resources Center to undertake a nationwide survey of regulatory programs pertaining to the effect of forest practices on water. The author pointed out that few such programs were effectively enforced, and that most were confined to sedimentation control through planting grassy strips. None paid much attention to the chemical composition of water in stream, which was affected significantly by streamside harvest practices, especially by nitrogen discharges. He argued that in-stream water quality monitoring be adopted that would indicate cumulative in-stream levels of nitrogen. He argued that monitoring systems that could be placed in stream and produce continuous records were available for some chemicals and quite likely to be soon for others. There is a good reason to believe that deforestation has considerable adverse effect on water quality, and that recovery of pre-cut conditions is relatively slow, much slower than would be believed from the mere regeneration of trees. A recent study of forested watersheds that had not been cut in recent years, and reforested ones that had been cut and were now regrown, had very different characteristics. Differences detected through field observations could be confirmed by aerial photographs of the watershed conditions a half century ago, which distinguished between forested and denuded watersheds at that time. The authors argued, therefore, that even buffer strips, while perhaps reducing erosion and sedimentation in the short term, would take many, many years, and it's not really known how long, to be restored to their former condition. In other words, if one wished to restore the quality of water needed by modern society, one needed to adopt a more extensive program of forest protection and restoration, including a far more adequate set of forest water standards and their enforcement. And we want to thank Sam Hayes for this white paper on forests and waters. Moving back to news. Survey finds backing for old-growth forests. A poll finds 75% of people in the Northwest want an end to old-growth logging in national forests, in this story by Michael Milstein of The Oregonian. A new public opinion poll indicates that 3 of every 4 people in Oregon and Washington want an end to logging of old-growth trees in national forests, a conviction that holds true even in rural counties long dependent on logging and other resource industries. It also extends across political party lines, according to the poll scheduled for release. The survey, commissioned by the Northwest Environmental Groups and completed by the research firm Davis and Hibbets Incorporated of Portland, suggests that the public has reached a strong consensus on a prominent public land issue that policymakers continue to debate. People today view old growth as something different and special, said Adam Davis of the polling firm, which has conducted surveys for the timber industry and political polling for the Oregonian. I am impressed with the breadth of support extending across every subgroup we had for protection of old growth. Among the 600 Oregon and Washington residents surveyed, 75% wanted protection of the mature forests known as old growth. But pollsters and forest activists were especially struck that residents of urban counties distance from logging and those in rural counties long tied to logging, agriculture, and other resource industries held largely the same views. in the urban counties of Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, Benton, Lane, and Deschutes in Oregon, and Clark King, Pierce, Thurston, Snohomish, Whatcom, and Kitsap in Washington, 79% either strongly supported or somewhat supported old-growth protection, while 16% opposed it and 5% didn't know. In the other more rural counties, 67% wanted protection for old growth, 26% opposed it, and 6% didn't know. The percentages don't total 100 because the figures were rounded. The margin of error was plus or minus 4 percentage points, and about one-third of those polled lived in rural areas. Representative Peter DeFazio, a Democrat from Oregon, said Wednesday that the sentiment suggests a public desire to stop logging old growth areas, which inspire emotional protest, and instead focus on less controversial thinning of younger crowded trees. DeFazio unsuccessfully proposed such a strategy during discussion of the Northwest Forest Plan in the 1994 Clinton administration compromise to protect wildlife habitat while allowing limited logging that currently is not working. Maybe the time is right to make another run at the issue and try again to resolve it, DeFazio said. Support for old growth protection declined an average of 5% in both urban and rural counties after arguments both in favor of and against protection were presented to people surveyed. That small change suggests that most are not easily swayed, Davis said. The rhetoric isn't having an impact. It's what they're seeing out in the forest, and there's less of it. The fate of old growth trees has long been the centerpiece of debate in Northwest forests, partly because they hold imperiled species such as the northern spotted owl, and I might add salmon. Douglas fir forests on the west side of the Cascade Range usually take on characteristics of old growth, including large tree and down debris, at about 200 years old. Old growth made up 50 to 70% of the forest west of the Cascade Crest before logging began, according to a 2000 report by the National Research Council, and it constitutes about 15% of the same forests today. The Northwest Forest Plan placed 86% of the 8 million remaining acres of federal old-growth forests in reserves to protect their character, leaving the other 14% available to logging. Agencies project that 3%, a quarter million acres, of the old-growth open to logging will be cut during the next decade, although more younger forest is expected to mature into old-growth during the same period. Mike Dombeck, U.S. Forest Service Chief in the Clinton administration, had called for an inventory and protection of the remaining old-growth forests. However, new Chief Dale Bosworth supports continued mapping of old-growth, but has taken no position on whether or how it should be protected, agency spokeswoman Heidi Valetkovich said. The new survey makes clear that the public wants old-growth left out of the logging mix, and Bosworth should take heed, said James Johnstonoff of the Cascadia Wildlands Project in Eugene, one of the groups that sponsored the poll. There's no real constituency for old-growth logging anymore, he said. People know that they need wood products, but we can get these from second growth and other forests. Getting wood products from old growth is like getting ivory from elephants, oil from whales, and making toilet paper from silk. And conservatives are seeking an IRS inquiry on environmental group status in this story by Anne-Marie Chaker of the Wall Street Journal. A conservative nonprofit group backed by tobacco, oil companies, and the logging company Boise Cascade is asking the Internal Revenue Service to revoke the tax-exempt status it granted Rainforest Action Network, an environmental group known for high-pressure campaigns to change corporate behavior. The move could accelerate a war of the nonprofits, with activist groups on the right and left challenging the tax exemptions of opponents. Frontiers of Freedom, which calls itself the antithesis of the environmental movement, says it will challenge other environmental groups if its effort is successful. In a letter to the IRS earlier this week, Frontiers contends that Rainforest Action is violating federal law by using tax-deductible donations to fund its advocacy campaigns. Under IRS rules, the funds are supposed to go towards public education, but Frontiers contends that the past activities as attempting to prevent a ship from leaving port and blocking the entrance to San Francisco offices of Mitsubishi Bank don't qualify. Rainforest Action Network defends its activities. We believe that when laws are unjust, they can be broken in a symbolic way, says Executive Director Christopher Hatch. He adds that the group received a letter from the IRS in 1997 stating that it had been audited and that it continued to qualify for its tax exemption. He also said that less than 1% of the group's budget goes to picketing and other activities where laws could be broken. The group's other activities include research and more conventional forms of education on environmental issues. The Rainforest case could boil down to how the IRS defines educational, and that isn't clear, lawyers say. Under the tax code enforced by the IRS, tax-exempt groups that support politicians or do substantial lobbying for specific legislation don't qualify for tax-deductible donations, but educational nonprofits that don't engage in activity related to partisan political campaigns can qualify for tax-deductible contributions. In addition to Rainforest Action, the latter group, known as a 501c3 for the section of the code that covers them, includes charities and churches as well as groups such as the Trust for Public Land, the Audubon Society, and the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise. To determine whether groups qualify, the IRS examines the methods that organizations use to develop and present their views. Groups must present a factual foundation for their positions, and their presentations should avoid substantial use of disparaging and inflammatory terms, the code says. In a ruling in 1975 near the end of the Vietnam War, the IRS disqualified groups whose primary activity was sponsoring demonstrations at which participants were urged to block vehicles or pedestrians, prevent the movement of supplies, or disrupt the work of the government. The Rainforest Action case locates the issue squarely in an area where it's very indeterminate as to where the IRS stands, said Francis Hill, a University of Miami law professor, who notes that the agency's most recent rulings on charities and political activism are nearly 20 years old. Some lawyers who specialize in tax-exempt organizations see no problem in Rainforest Action's activities. Bruce R. Hopkins, an attorney in Kansas City, Missouri, points out to the IRS's 1979 review of the Infant Formula Action Coalition, a group he represented that conducted a national boycott of companies that marketed infant formula in developing countries. After an initial rejection, the IRS granted the group's request for charity status, in effect saying the group could organize a boycott to carry out an educational objective. But Marcus Owens, a former director of the Exempt Organizations Division of the IRS, sees some merit in Frontier's point of view. Just because you're educational doesn't mean you can achieve your educational goal in any way you choose, he says. If indeed the organization is encouraging and actively directing its members to violate the law, then there's a potential problem. Frontiers, which says it began looking into Rainforest activities last fall, was founded in 1995 by former Senator Malcolm Wallop, a Wyoming Republican and friend of Vice President Dick Cheney. Its biggest contributors include Philip Morris Company, Exxon Mobil Corporation, and RJR Reynolds Tobacco Holdings Incorporated. It has two components, a 501c3 and a 501c4, which is tax-exempt but can't accept tax-deductible donations. It says it uses grassroots activity, congressional lobbying, publications, media appearances, and coalition building to further its own goals. George Landreth, the group's executive director, says Frontiers chose Rainforest Action for a test case because it stood out in a review of the workings of groups that don't agree with us about property rights issues. As a practical matter, if this had come up a year ago, I wouldn't have expected the IRS to have done much about it, Mr. Landreth says, but our hope is that the current administration will expect the law to be abided by. During the Clinton administration, the nonpartisan Americans United for Separation of Church and State complained to the IRS about the political activities of certain churches in 25 separate instances. Americans United says it knows of only one group that had its charitable status yanked as a result, Branch Ministries, which had run newspaper ads encouraging Christians not to vote for Mr. Clinton. Some lawyers say the strategy of challenging tax-exempt status could be used more often, especially if the McCain-Feingold campaign finance bill, which would ban soft money contributions from corporations, labor unions, and wealthy individuals to national political parties, becomes law and donors start channeling their money through advocacy nonprofits. It's unclear how the IRS will react. We evaluate the comments that come into us based on the merits they have and the substance they contain, says IRS spokesperson Don Roberts. Even if the IRS disagrees with Frontier, reporting political enemies to the IRS is an effective tactic because it forces the enemy to spend resources and sleepless nights, says Jeffrey Yablon, a tax lawyer specializing in exempt organizations at Shaw Pittman in Washington, who has represented a wide variety of clients. Adverse publicity is an added bonus, particularly if it scares away donors. And a court has rejected right-of-way claims across the Utah Monument and other lands. In a landmark decision, U.S. District Court Judge Tina Campbell in Salt Lake City, Utah, ruled in favor of the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance and the Sierra Club in their suit against three Utah counties for illegally blading roads in the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument and in other areas under review for wilderness protection. The suit against Garfield, San Juan, and Kane counties involved 16 routes crossing some of Utah Utah's most fragile and scenic landscapes. They are located in Harts Point, east of Canyonlands National Park in the Mokuth Mountain Wilderness Study Area and in the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. The counties graded the routes in late September and early October of 1996, while tempers flared over the creation of the monument and the BLM's review of certain areas for eventual wilderness designation. This decision is enormously important for the future of our public lands. No more will the counties be able to undermine the protection of National Parks, Bureau of Land Management lands, and wildlife refuges with the blunt edge of a bulldozer, said Heidi McIntosh, an attorney who originally filed the case in 1996. At issue is the interpretation of an 1866 federal law known as RS 2477. That law provides that the right-of-way for the construction of highways across public lands not reserved for public uses is hereby granted. While the Congress repealed RS 2477 in 1976, existing rights-of-way were grandfathered. In brief, the court agreed that the routes, which had largely been created by haphazard random use of unidentified users, were not valid RS 2477 roads because, 1, they had never been constructed, 2, they were not highways because they did not access a particular destination, and 3, in some cases were on land that had been set aside solely for coal development. 7 Utah counties have alleged that they have 10,000 RS-2477 rights-of-way, a virtual spiderweb of routes located in streams, wash bottoms, and across fragile desert soils. Many of the routes are invisible, having never been constructed or maintained by the counties, and would be hazardous, if not impossible, to navigate with a vehicle. The RS-2477 has become an element of nearly every legal dispute involving public lands management. San Juan County recently alleged in court that Canyonlands National Park could not close Salt Creek, which had suffered severe ecological damage from jeeps because it was an RS-2477 road. Counties also argue that the BLM could not close certain ORV tracks because they are also RS-2477 roads, despite documented environmental harm. Recently, Governor Leavitt, the Bureau of Land Management, and several Utah counties have come under fire by conservationists for engaging in closed-door negotiations seeking to settle thousands of RS-2477 claims throughout the state. According to McIntosh, this decision should restore some common sense to the RS-2477 issue. We do need sensible transportation. What we don't need is a morass of Jeep and ORV trails snaking through fragile landscapes like national parks that we all thought were already protected. And that's all the time we have for news. If you'd like to get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzief@cruzio.com. That's cruzief@cruzio.com. Or send letters to Earth First Radio at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And please be sure to send all announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. Once again, that's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. And they could really use some donations right now. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Go to the website www.microradio.net/FRSC and tune us in. You could also try www.live365.com/Free Radio Santa Cruz or search for Free Radio Santa Cruz. And there's lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz anytime. If you're looking for Earth First Radio archive shows, you can find them at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net and search for Earth First Radio. This is show number 148. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney. Off the CD Keep It Wild, I'm Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And we're going to listen to some Casey Neal now off of his Riff Raff CD, and this one's called Bear in Mind.
Up on the ridge line where the trees decline in the arms of your valleys, deep winter time, oh, child of the northland, wild to the core and restless, sensing danger closing in. And you are my totem vision. and familiar, a symbol of the strength I am trying to carry. You move unseen like a passing dream, moonlight reflecting off high mountain snow. What you see, existence without boundaries. I don't know where you are, but I pray that you are well. One day may I hear the stories you have to tell. And if you see others like me, may you run fast. Most of my kind, they are killing the past. But to ease your fear, as the roads close in, there are those of us who fight for you and know we are kin. Your cascade.